This was an insidious institutional problem. There is nothing like it that I've seen anywhere in any other institution.
That's Attorney Erwin Zolkin speaking. He is the principal of a firm called the Zolkin Law Firm, New York injury and sexual abuse attorney, and California sexual abuse and accident lawyer. And he is talking about the Catholic Church. This is G'day World 368 on the Podcast Network. My name is Cameron Riley.
There are no other institutions that I can think of that would allow, even if you use their statistics, 4 or 5% of their employees to knowingly abuse children. Just not heard of. If you were, just by analogy, if you were talking about a school and it had 100 employees and they were aware that 4 or 5 of them were abusing children, it just wouldn't stand. It wouldn't be tolerated. And I think their percentage is skewed very low. I think it's closer to probably 10 or 12%.
Wow. And so from your experience in these cases, do you have any insight as to what it is about the culture inside the Catholic Church that has allowed or encouraged this to happen?
Well, I think it comes from a couple of things. One is, I think that people, you know, pedophilia, fibophilia are incurable diseases. It's an illness. But these people are very manipulative, incredibly calculating, and obsessed with sex. And they look for ways in which to become to have access. And one place that they know they can get access is to become a priest within the Catholic Church. And it was a sort of a perfect environment for that. For these people, because they're left largely alone. I mean, it's a very reclusive way of living, and they have access to children. In fact, part of their purpose in life is to groom young boys to become priests. So they have the access. I think that celibacy is on some level a impossibility, clearly in my mind, but I think in some ways it's a contributing factor to all of this. I don't know that, some people say, well, these guys are homosexuals, it's a homosexual problem. But I don't think that's necessarily the case. I don't think that it's a homosexual problem. I think it's the fact that the sex is a homosexual sex is because the boys are accessible. And in some ways are relatively safe. They're not going to get them pregnant. So I think they almost don't care who they have sex with, as long as they can have sex and as long as it's a child. But boys were more accessible. So, I mean, I think it's just the environment, and then, of course, the extreme secrecy and the covering it up and the lack of sanction, I think makes it, it has made it the perfect storm for this kind of problem.
The reason I invited Mr. Zolkin onto the show was there was a recent court victory in the United States back early in March in a case called Doe versus the Holy See, where the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the Vatican can be sued in a United States court over alleged molestation by its priests. And this is a pretty significant ruling. This changes a lot of things. Erwin explains.
There's actually two cases that our appellate courts or appeals courts have ruled on allowing sexual abuse victims to sue the Vatican or the Holy See as a result of damages they've suffered from the sexual abuse as minors by priests, Catholic priests. And it's these are pretty landmark decisions. The interesting thing is that both of these cases come to the same conclusion, but with very different reasons. You know, the Holy See is it's a sovereign entity. It enjoys the status of a state under international law, and in the United States is immune, as are all foreign entities, from most lawsuits. But we do have a statute in, that does permit certain types of actions to proceed against foreign entities for personal injury damages. And the question that these cases presented was whether you could sue, a victim could sue the Holy See in its capacity as a quasi-employer of bishops and archbishops and priests within the Catholic Church in the United States. And in essence, they have held it that we can, for their participation on some level in allowing these bishops to cover up the harm that was done by priests, and or to fail to report, or in fact to, in some ways, even encourage the behavior by just moving them from one location to another. So these are very critical. It's a very critical. These are critical opinions, I would say.
So how is this different from the court cases that have happened in the past as a result of clergy sexual abuse?
Well, what's different is that now you're suing the Vatican. You're actually suing the Pope. And at least until this year in this country, that was not permitted. And it's been tried in a few jurisdictions and few venues, but it's always been... The Pope or the Vatican has always been granted this sovereign immunity status, and has not been held accountable or responsible for the acts of what really are their agents or employees within this country.
So previously, it's just been the local diocese that's been involved in court cases?
Exactly, exactly. So the limitation has been that the lawsuits really are involving just the diocese that were involved with the priest directly, or the religious order that was involved with the priest directly, or the nun, if that may be the case. But the Holy See, who directs and controls and sets policies and standards of conduct, really the sort of the chairman of the board, if you will, was never held accountable. And now there is this potential that the chairman will be held accountable.
From your experience, Mr. Zolkin, is the instance of sexual abuse claims against the Catholic Church in the United States on the increase? It seems that we're reading more stories about it all the time. Is this just that it's getting more press coverage, or are the instances actually on the rise?
Well, it's been, there was a massive activity in these cases following sort of the breakthrough circumstance in Boston with lawsuits that were brought against the Archdiocese of Boston, and the revelations that came out of a criminal investigation that was conducted by the Attorney General of Massachusetts that really revealed for the first time the level of documentation and knowledge that not only did the Massachusetts or the Archdiocese of Boston, but what was really known nationally. And it spread like a wildfire across the country. Once that broke open and people started to realize they were not alone, and there were others who had suffered this sort of horrific harm as children, started to come out. And it spread throughout the country, and probably was most prominent from 2002 to about 2007. And now there's pending legislation in several states to lift the statutes of limitations to allow these claims to proceed in other states throughout the country. So we had a big 1,000 cases in California that were filed and settled for about $1.2 billion U.S. dollars. There have been major group settlements like that throughout the country. In the next state that looks like it has a possibility of amending its statute of limitations is the state of New York, which has, I believe, will be have an incredible number of victims come forward. So it's not done. This is still going on. In fact, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, which is the organization that all bishops belong to in the United States, and it's sort of the political arm of the Catholic Church in America, has just completed its a study and has found that the claims are on the rise.
I believe that the U.S. CCB said that they've spent about $23 million in 2008 to prevent sexual abuse. Is the Catholic Church getting this under control? Are these claims stemming from things that happened in the past, or are these also including, you know, recent cases?
Well, I think the great majority of these cases are older cases, or cases that I think the bulk of them derive from what took place in the early 60s through the mid-1980s. But one of the problems is that we won't know for many years where we stand today, because people don't come to grips with this until well into adulthood. And it's only then that they make their sort of a causal connection between the abuse they suffered and the consequences. And that's when something goes off in their head and they either come forward or are prepared to deal with it, and they become a statistic. Until then, they're really not known. So if we'll know in 10, 20 years from now what if this has tapered off in the late 80s and 90s, or if it's been pretty much the same. We just don't know. In terms of what the Catholic Church in America has done to help to prevent the abuse, I think there have been efforts that have been made. There are new policies that are in place. How well these policies are being monitored, how efficient they are, how effective they are, it still remains to be seen. You know, we still have people who come to us who are victims and have been victims for some time and are seeking the assistance of these dioceses, as is mandated now by their policies, and are rebuffed and treated as if though they're adversaries immediately. So I don't know if they've gotten it yet. You know, this is a corporate culture that's gone on for decades, for centuries, and it's not an easy one to change. It's a complex problem that most people don't quite understand until they get their feet wet and get into this business.
Can you explain to us the impact of the letter that was issued in the early 60s, instruction on the manner of proceeding in cases of solicitation, that's had on these cases?
Yeah, that's referred to in Latin as the incrimina solicitationis. That was an edict that was a papal edict Pope John the 23rd had issued in 1962 that dealt with crimes of solicitation for sex by religious and priests, and it addresses various sexual activities, including bestiality and abuse of minors. And what the instruction in essence provides is that any information that is brought to the attention of church hierarchy regarding such activities is to be kept under complete secrecy. So much so that the sanction is excommunication. And that set a policy in this country for bishops chancellors, vicars general, other principals within the in diocese who had knowledge, not to report to civil authorities, not to report to outside medical people, but to contain that information to protect the church from scandal. And they've created insular institutions within the country to treat these individuals that were Catholic institutions that were as well mandated to keep secret these behaviors. So it's not like these people, you know, were reported to authorities, to Child Protective Services. These perpetrators were sent to university hospitals or public hospitals or even private secular hospitals for care. This was all very engineered and contained within Catholic institutions to preserve and protect, above all, the church from the sin of scandal. And that the import of that document, which was revealed in the documents that were obtained by the Attorney General of the state of Massachusetts, the import of that is that it was actually the effectively canon law. The same had the same effect as canon law, requiring secrecy.
And how does that work with U.S. law? I mean, if somebody in Catholic Church, if a priest has knowledge of one of these crimes but doesn't report it to the authorities, isn't that in conflict with existing law?
Yeah, well, yes, and much of what the church does or its views on these issues takes it in, or puts it directly in conflict with civil law. And that's been the subject of a lot of lawsuits and litigation and court opinions dealing with these issues. The position that the church takes is that under the Constitution of the United States, our First Amendment, the First Amendment guarantees a separation between church and state and protects a religious institution's practices or right to the free exercise of its religion. And what they've argued is that this is church doctrine, they have their religious and doctrinal reasons for doing these things, and it's not up to civil authority to question that. It has no right to question that under the First Amendment. That argument has not carried the day in any civil court, because the view of civil courts is that civil authority still is the reigning authority of the country. And if you're going to protect criminal behavior, you're going to be subject to civil authority or criminal authority. And if you have information, that's not going to be protected. That can prevent the abuse of children or any other crime. So they've been struggling and battling and trying to keep secret and private this information now for many years, but certainly in these cases,
and
not too successfully.
Does that that document, that canon law, still exist?
Oh, canon law? Yes. Canon law is. What canon law is a set of codes that are the codes and statutes of the Catholic Church, and it was in 1917 that they were first established in here, the Code of Canon Law, and it deals with all kinds of doctrine and procedures. It was modified and amended in 1983. It still exists. And there are the equivalents of canon law. So that 1962 document, the In Crimina document, for example, is a papal edict, which was published to all bishops in the United States, published having a very specific meaning under Catholic law. It gives it then the same status as canon law.
So sorry, what I meant to ask was, does that Crumen Solicitationis edict, is it still active inside?
It's been at this point, it's been rejected.
Right.
By vote of the conference.
Right.
It's no longer in accepted.
How does that work with papal
officially?
How does it work with papal infallibility?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I don't think I can tell you that they have even the authority to reject it.
I sometimes hear from Catholic friends that the instance of child sexual abuse in in the Catholic Church is no different as a percentage of sexual abuse that happens outside of the church. I was wondering if your law firm has any experience in handling cases in other Christian denominations or in other religions. Is this something that is exclusive to the Catholic Church, or do we see a similar percentage of cases in other religions or denominations?
The law in the United States is facially neutral. I mean, there are no statutes dealing with the prosecution of these cases against the Catholic Church only. It is for any private institution in this country. And our firm has been handling these cases now for many, many years, hundreds of cases around the country. And I will tell you that the vast majority are Catholic cases. We have a few Methodists, a few Episcopalian cases, some Boy Scout cases, but they're a handful.
There was a report just recently that in the diocese in Santa Rosa in California, 17 priests from the diocese have been accused of sexual molestation. I mean, to me, that's just astounding that there's this...
I'll tell you, in San Diego diocese, it's 60 priests.
60 priests in one diocese?
60.
Those
are the ones that we know of. I mean, we're finding out every day about new ones. You know, this 60 priests is the ones we found out and we're able to discover in the last 3 or 4 years. But I mean, just within the last few months, for example, here in San Diego, we just discovered that there's a group of victims from yet another priest that nobody'd heard of before. So, yes, be surprised at all. That's why I say that this 4% that the church claims of bad apples is a very misleading and low number.
Last question, Mr. Zolkin, and I'll let you go. You talked before about civil law taking precedent over canon law in the United States. How does that apply to things like sexual preference or gender-based discrimination inside the church? The inability for women or for homosexual men to play the same role in the church that a straight male does?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And the position that courts have taken, not just in terms of the church or, I mean, even in other organizations, for example, with Boy Scouts, you know, there have been cases where it's been claimed that having the Boy Scouts not admit girls is sex discrimination or gender-based discrimination. When it comes to private institutions in terms of allowing some level of discrimination, the courts have had more of a hands-off in that regard and have said, listen, we're not going to take or claim that the protections of the Constitution, which really govern sort of state action, that we're not going to apply that to private institutions. If I want to have a men's club, I can have a men's club. I'm not engaging the state in sanctioning my men's club. So in those circumstances, the state has taken a hands off. But where there is a criminal behavior, where there is the potential for severe injury or damage, the state will in fact step in to protect. And so what the courts have held is that the canon law, at least to the extent that those canons that deal with procedures, that are in direct conflict with civil procedures or criminal procedures, in that case, the procedures of the civil or criminal process will take precedent or priority.
If you're in the United States and you want to contact Erwin Zolkin and the Zolkin Law Firm, zolkin.com, Zalkin.com. Thanks for listening.